Good morning, may it please the court. Can I start with mentioning a late filing, yesterday's filing of supplemental authority by Safeco? I'd like to point out that the quoted passage that's referred to in the...
Is this from the FAM case, I guess?
Sorry?
What was the supplemental authority?
We have not received, I have not received.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
No.
Maybe you should skip it? No.
It's a case from Nevada.
The district court, federal district court case?
In Nevada, yes.
Okay, we're familiar with that case.
Okay. It was filed yesterday. I was not familiar with it until it was filed.
Okay.
So you probably have, maybe you have an advance of me. At any rate, it does not deal with the issues here in that case, Pignola. The insurance company was arguing, even though all of the policy limits had been paid, liability had been paid, and had been paid up to the limits, were arguing that a provision requiring a settlement before any UIM payment was effective to rebut an allegation that there had been a delay in payment, even though the payments had already been made. So the next paragraph after the quoted paragraph in the submission by Safeco makes that pretty clear. Our basic position in the case is that the new statute, the 609 statute, if I can refer to it by 609 to mean 609.1c, the new statute does not apply. And the reason for that is that there's a long-standing history in Colorado jurisprudence, UIM jurisprudence in particular, that says that it is the policy, insurance policy itself, that must govern. And that the insurance statutes, much like many consumer codes, are there only to protect insurers from attempts to dilute or circumvent payment of policies. In this case, the policy, I think, is pretty clear. It offers payment for any sums not paid by the other driver, the tortfeasor. And since it does that, then the statute 609 does not apply.
Counsel, what specific language in the policy are you saying requires payment for anything above what has been paid?
Okay. The policy language I'm referring to is on that sentence. It's in the addenda to the opening brief under Part C of the insuring agreement. It says that an underinsured motor vehicle under Part C means a vehicle which is bonded for bodily injury, etc., but the amount paid for bodily injury under such insurance is not enough to pay the full amount that the insured is legally entitled to recover. So that's the provision we rely on.
That defines the underinsured motor vehicle.
Yes,
but in and of itself, doesn't it follow off of subparagraph A of Part C, which defines when they will pay damages for an accident caused by an uninsured motor vehicle? Are you asking us to ignore A and just look at C? Because doesn't A say the limits of liability will only pay when they exhaust the limits of liability? That's what it says when it involves an underinsured motor vehicle.
And that's what it said in your case of Bitcomo. which was, had been decided almost 20 years ago on policy grounds. And what we're really saying is that when you buy a policy that says it's going to cover amounts not paid by a tort user, then in that case, that's what you expect to get.
But counsel, you're relying on a definitional provision, not the coverage provision. You keep conflating the two.
I beg to differ. Part C is entitled the insuring agreement. Paragraphs A, B, and C. I'm referring to paragraph C under the insuring agreement.
Which defines an underinsured or uninsured motor vehicle. It's not the coverage provision, that's A. You're ignoring A. It says limits liability.
I haven't ignored A in the brief. We briefed that extensively.
All right, well, what do you say about A here today then?
What I say is what this court has said on several different occasions, and that is that if you make a good faith effort to settle the case against the tortfeasor, you get as much as you can get under the circumstances, then that exhausts the policy limit. That recovery exhausts the policy limit. And that's been the law in Colorado for almost two decades now. It's not based on any particular statute. It's based on the policy of promoting settlement. And generally, I would submit in the interest of fairness. Because as we all know, the litigation business these days is getting more and more expensive. And these cases, in the great scheme of things, are not always large cases. And so when you proceed with a claim and the costs start to mount and mount, you, in order to do a good job for your client, you've got to try to make the best settlement you can in almost every one of these cases. The cost of these cases can exceed the policy limits, and a lot of policies that are enforced.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Jacko. Let's assume for purposes of argument that we disagree with your reading of the policy. At that point, doesn't 609 require us to conclude that your opponent's argument is the right one?
No, because if you recall, the Colorado trial lawyers filed a brief, an amicus brief in this case. And we take the same position that they did, which is the policy decision which underlies the Ben Colo Tye and Freeman cases in this court should also apply to the policy limits in the statute.
Well, wait, doesn't that mean that we would have to completely reread the statute, rewrite it?
No, sir. I don't think so. I think when you look at the policy provisions that were interpreted in Ben Como, what you'll see is pretty clear language saying you're not going to get paid UIM until the policy is completely exhausted, the liability policy is completely exhausted. Notwithstanding that language, this court interpreted it to mean when you get a settlement, the best you can get, you give notice to the insurance company. Don't forget, the companies here have rights of subrogation as well. So I think that the same policy, and we have argued that the same policy should apply. Colorado Trial Lawyers Association and the amicus brief happen to agree with that position.
Well, counsel, the legislature changed the language of the statute. And it seems to me that the position of amicus and now your position is that we should just forget that, just ignore it. Just pretend that the statute is just like it was before it was amended. What legal authority do you have for the proposition that we can do that?
I don't have any authority specifically for that point. And I'm not really asking you to ignore it. I'm asking you to interpret it to mean that if someone is injured and they get the best deal they can from the person who injured them, that should satisfy a requirement that policy limits be met.
Well, you're asking us to interpret it, as you put it, exactly the way the prior statute was interpreted. So you are asking us to say that despite the change in language, there was really no change in the statute.
And that gets to the next point, which is whether or not this statute amends and and supersedes all of the policy-oriented decisions of this court in the past. So if you look at two recent cases, by that, this is in the reply brief, the Rivera and Jacobs cases, you find that it's very difficult for a simple statutory provision, such as 609(1c), to simply eradicate all of those prior decisions unless it specifically refers to it. So what we're saying is that 609 does not do that. That was a holding on a couple of slightly different issue in the Jacobs and Rivera cases, that 609 did not impose a complete scheme of UI insurance, and nor did it overrule the Terranova case and other cases which had followed Terranova earlier on.
Are you suggesting that the Safeco policy provisions are simply different from what the statute allows an insurer to do, and arguing that we should just file a policy and not worry about the statute?
Well, I'm arguing on the basis of this court's decisions. The first one, an earlier case, is Jones and USAA. And what happened, there was a complaint by a claimant that she had lost wages. And wages were defined in the policy, and wages were defined in the PIP statute in those days. And this court held that once the definition of the policy was met, they didn't even have to look at the statute. And in a similar case, the Geiger case, which is a decision of this court as well, that case went so far as to say that a notice provision in an insurance policy prevailed over the notice requirements of the statute. That's the simplest way I can put it. So that what we're saying here is that when you look at the policy, and you can argue about whether it's a definition of an underinsured motorist, it comes under insuring agreement. When you buy a policy, if you're a regular customer of these companies, you look at this and you say, I'm going to buy this policy because it covers what's not covered if someone runs into me, which is exactly what happened here. You might read the provision about policy limits as well, but that has Safeco against this if this were decided under the prior law, then our position would be correct. What we're saying is it is to be decided under the prior law because 609 does not overrule all of that. And I have only a minute and a half left. Unless there's another question, I'd like to reserve that.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Would it be helpful if I had copies of what was filed electronically yesterday for the court?
If it is the Nevada case, we are aware of the Nevada case.
May it please the court and counsel, Lawrence Stone appearing on behalf of Safeco Insurance Company of America. Let me first begin with the issue of the application of the policy to this loss, and in particular the definition. And let me first begin by talking about some terminology that's applicable to insurance policies in general. There's definitions, there's grants of coverage, there's policy conditions, exclusions, as well as limits. Here, what plaintiff's counsel is attempting to do is to
convert a definition of an underinsured motorist to a grant of coverage. As the court has already realized, paragraph A of the insuring agreement is the grant of coverage. It's broad in nature. It provides coverage, we'll pay damages for which an insured is legally entitled to recover from the owner or operator of an uninsured motor vehicle or underinsured motor vehicle because of bodily injury sustained by that insured and caused by an accident. That is very broad. It is that you have to read the policy as a whole. You have to apply the limits of the policy. Here we have $100,000 in the limits. You have to apply, the insured has to meet the definition of an underinsured motorist as a condition to having coverage. You also have to apply the excess insurance clause that appears on the last page of the coverage. Underinsured motorist coverage shall be excess over all bodily injury liability bonds or policies applicable at the time of the accident. A definition is not the same as a grant of coverage. We have never contested that the Jordans met the definition of an underinsured motorist until they stipulated that their damages were not in excess of $100,000. That's a game changer. So with that in mind and some other fundamentals about how Safeco's uninsured motorist coverage interacts with Bristol West's $100,000 in liability insurance. The starting point is Bristol West's $100,000 in liability insurance. That is protection for the tortfeasor. It represents the first layer of coverage. Safeco's underinsured motorist coverage is in addition to that. It stacks on top of that liability insurance. And it comes into play, it's triggered when the, in this situation, there has been a claim asserted against bodily injury liability insurance carrier. In fact, there were settlements. $60,000 for Mr. Jordan, $38,000 for 500.
So was that amount paid not enough to pay the full amount of the insurer's damages?
That's a question of fact.
Yes.
Okay. And it's also going to be a question that this court is going to have to address. Our position is that irrespective of whether that is sufficient to compensate them for their injuries, that they do not have a claim until they can establish damages in excess of.
I know, I understand your position. Right. I'm really just looking at the definition of an underinsured motor vehicle.
Okay.
I have assumed this is a case of an underinsured motor vehicle because the amount paid may not have been enough to pay the full amount of their damages. They didn't stipulate that their damages were, I forget the number, 68 or 62.
Correct.
They just said it's not over 100.
Correct.
It could be 90. Therefore, the amount paid wasn't enough to pay the full amount. We're still dealing with an underinsured motor vehicle. But that takes us back, as you say, to the coverage provision under A, and there it has to be that the limits of liability of the tortfeasor's policy have been exhausted. And it seems to me what we're dealing with here is, what does the word exhausted mean?
Mm-hmm.
Plaintiff's counsel says exhausted means whatever Ben Como said. Although I think in Ben Como, I don't think the word in the policy was exhausted. I think it was used up, if I'm not mistaken. So the question is, what does exhausted mean here? And I guess my question to you really is, did Safeco adjust this policy after the 2008 statutory amendments so that they would, so that they dovetail, and then we can just follow what the statutory amendments are? Did they seem to not get their policy lined up with the statute, and then we have to look at the policy itself before we even deal with it?
The statute was amended and revised. And
this policy was issued after the statute was amended, right? This is after the statute.
Yes, if you look at the bottom of any of the
pages. Yeah, I know, it says it there. Okay.
Right. And also there is a discovery response in the record, and that can be found at record at page 230.
Yeah, I don't think it's disputed. The policy is after the after the amendment and the accidents after the amendment. So we're dealing with post-amendment events here.
To get to your question about what the word exhaustion means, it's that is a more complicated question. Okay, and let me respond in this way: is that first, if you look at the policy, I would view in paragraph A the language you're referring to as a condition to the grant of coverage because of the word "if." They will pay only if certain events occur. It's not an issue here. And the reason it's not an issue is there's two ways to look at the exhaustion issue. First is that if the Nevada case, that is a situation not present here. There, the insurance carrier would not permit the insured to arbitrate a UIM claim because they hadn't done anything in relation to the bodily injury claim. We don't have that issue here because Bristol West settled with the plaintiffs. Another way to look at the exhaustion issue is that it requires that the Jordans use up the limits of Bristol West's policy. Take $100,000. That's not an issue here. What under the then Como decision, what the Court of Appeals held at that time is that a less than limit settlement will be deemed to be exhaustion.
And did the court hold that as a matter of policy, or was it relying on the statute for that?
I think it was more as a matter of policy. And actually, I think it is also because of statute. Because the statute oriented to the amounts paid, unlike the amended statute. If you go back and if you look at the original version of the statute, it orients in section 5
amount paid.
Right.
It says.
Okay. That is one of the distinctions with the amended statute. We don't orient to amount paid anymore. We orient to the limit of the underlying bodily injury liability limit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think it was an issue both of the statutory language pointing to the amount paid.
I don't think there's any question the statutory language changed. The question is whether your policy
complies.
Not that it complies, but does it ensure that it accords with the statute, or do you give them more, so to speak?
I understand what you're getting at. Let me address. We could ignore the statute and get to the same result that we're arguing. And let me walk you through how that gets done. The first point is that there is no dispute about what Bristol West's limit is, $100,000, no dispute. Second, if you look at the definition prior to the stipulation, no dispute that the insurers met the definition. The third thing is that there's no dispute as to the amount of Safeco's UIM limit of $100,000. That's the upper cap. If you look at the grant of coverage, just the first part of A, including the one and the two, sustained by that insured, there is coverage. Then the next place to look is if you look at the excess clause.
Wait, why don't you look at the damages, what do you call the conditions?
I think that
if the conditions
can be ignored.
I'm sorry.
And you get to the same result. I think it can be ignored.
Okay.
All right. And I'll come back and answer your question. But next is that pursuant to the excess insurance clause, that the UIM coverage afforded shall be excess over all bodily injury liability bonds or policies applicable at the time.
And excess is not defined anywhere in this policy.
Correct. It's commonly,
commonly, excess is excess insurance is something else that we used to talk about, reinsurance policy, that kind of thing. But here you're saying excess is excess to the tortfeasor's policy.
It's in our brief, we cite to several cases about what, you know, there's a common definition of, it's understood that what it means is it's in addition to, it's excess of.
By the way, didn't the trial court here find that the excess provision had no applicability? She actually came out the other way, didn't she, on that?
Well, no, she cited, originally she came out, she ruled adverse to us. When we moved to reconsider, she ruled consistently with our arguments.
But she didn't ever say the excess clause applies here. She says excess, she said at one point, there's no excess insurance involved here.
I'd have to look at the court's file.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I can't address that right now, but if, to answer your question about the exhaustion clause, Safeco will pay damages under this coverage caused by an accident with an underinsured motor vehicle if and only if one or two apply. And one is the limits of liability under any applicable bodily injury liability bonds or policies have been exhausted by payments of judgments or settlements. So again, that orients to exhaustion of Bristol West's liability limits. And so this court can either determine that plaintiffs need to fully exhaust, or this court could rule consistently with Bencomo that a less than limit settlement is exhaustion for this purposes, but then you still have the excess clause that I pointed out to you before. When you tie all this together, it's entirely consistent with the statutory scheme for UIM benefits.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Stone, but I'd like to ask you a derivation of the question that I asked Mr. Jatko. It has to do with 609. 609 has obviously changed. And assuming for the purposes of argument that we agree with your position on the policy, turning to the statute, you just addressed what one of my concerns is. Are you saying that the statute has changed the risk concerning the gap in the first policy? Are you saying that, the statute has changed that risk from the insurer to the insurer?
I think that's right. And I think that what Mr. Jasko is arguing is that Safeco's UIM should drop down to the amount of settlements. Okay? I think that the new statute has changed the risk. It's created this issue of gaps or donut holes. I think that is, however, self-policing. It's self-policing in two respects. One is it encourages plaintiffs to maximize their bodily injury liability settlements. Get $100,000 or get awfully close to it, because if you don't, you're going to have a gap. Secondly, I think that it's self-policing on the industry's part, because as you all know, there is a risk. If Bristol West hung tight here, or if Mr. Jopko had pursued a claim and refused to settle, then Bristol is at risk of an excess verdict at a trial being assessed against its insured, resulting in a bad faith claim potentially by its insured against Bristol West. And because of that risk, it's insurance carriers, when they start getting a case that's close to limits, they throw in the top, because you don't want to risk that bad faith claim from an excess verdict. So by shifting the risk, as you point out, it's self-policing.
Mr. Stone, I'm going to ask you to go back to the policy language. Yeah. Because I'm looking at Bencomo, and the language there was, I quote, "There is no coverage until the limits of liability of all bodily injury liability bonds and policies that apply have been used up by payment of judgments or settlements."
Right.
And later in the opinion, the court seems to say that that's ambiguous. And I'm just wondering how that language differs materially from the policy language at issue here.
Well, the reason is because you can't ignore, you have to read the policy as a whole, you can't ignore the excess clause in Safeco's policy.
Well, how do we know that there wasn't an excess clause in the Bencomo case?
I can't answer that question. I don't, you know, Bencomo is, you know, decided under the old statute, and it also consistent with our position. If you read Bencomo closely, the court is saying that Bencomo can recover over and above only over and above the $25,000 in bodily injury liability coverage. He could not drop down. In Vancomo, he could not drop down to the $15,000 settlement. If you read the case closely, the court is making a decision that he will recover beginning when he can establish damages exceeding $25,000, which was the limit of liability insurance for the, I think it was a State Farm policy.
And that's the same position you take here?
Correct.
I think your time's up.
Yes, your time is up.
Yes, Mr. Stokin.
Thank you very much.
Hey, I'd say just a quick word about excess coverage that has just been raised by Mr. Stone. This was dealt with, I think, in this court's case, the Freeman case, at page 586. And what it says there is that underinsured motorist coverage is excess coverage, not an alternative to liability coverage or some optional protection which the injured party can choose in lieu of asserting a claim against an injured tortfeasor. So what the excess provision means to us is that you can't go in and make a UIN claim without first going to the tortfeasor and getting all you can, which is what I've said before. Another thing about the
can I ask you a question then along, you stipulated that your clients had no more than $100,000 in damages, right? The tortfeasor had $100,000 in insurance coverage. Just without the legal lease involved, how was he underinsured? He had enough insurance to cover your client's damages. How in ordinary environments was he underinsured?
But here's the problem. You get caught in a trap because why is Bristol going to pay you $100,000? They have no incentive to pay a policy limit. So you're going to be left, you're going to be stuck. 609 applies to this with a gap in coverage, which you may not be able to prove over 100, but as you said earlier, there could be another $20,000-$30,000 to collect.
But Mr. Shepard, one could argue that the tortfeasor's insurer has even less incentive under the regime you're talking about, because it knows that the rest of the damages are going to get picked up by the driver's underinsured motor vehicle coverage. So they have no incentive. In fact, the driver, what's the incentive for the injured person? I can just, $30,000, fine, I'll just go get the rest from my other carriers.
No, it's not that simple. And even in Vancomo's day, it wasn't that simple. You have to show that it's a good faith settlement. It's not something that you just flim-flam through in order to get to the UIM coverage. That was never the case under those.
Under that regime, the tortfeasor's insurer could take a harder line. Say, we know you have other insurance.
Don't give them any ideas. They take a hard enough line already. this is a tough case. I don't envy the court in coming to a fair conclusion. I mean, there's a lot of issues we never touched today in the time permitted. I think that our position overall is a fair argument. If it's not found to be correct, I think it's the fair argument. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. We'll issue a decision in course, and now.